for individuals interested in the medical field. Welcome to the Doc Talk Podcast, where doctors from around the world discuss groundbreaking work in the medical industry. Because in an ever-changing world, healthcare is constant.
Good morning, evening, or afternoon to listeners of the Doc Talk from around the world. I'm very excited to announce today's guest speaker. Dr. Ajit R. Menon is an experienced interventional cardiologist with over 27 years of experience with various reputed hospitals in Mumbai, including the Leelavati Hospital, Sir H. N. Reliance Hospital, Saifi and Breach Candy Hospitals. Apart from being an experienced clinical cardiologist, he is also an extremely experienced interventional cardiologist dealing with various types of complex coronary interventions. He regularly performs over 10 to 15 coronary angioplasties a week, many of which involves complex situations. He is a very well experienced in the use of rotablator, eczema laser, and various intercoronary imaging modalities like intravascular ultrasound and optical coherence tomography. He is a proctor involved in training cardiologists in the use of rotablator, left main coronary intervention, intravascular ultrasound, and OCT. He is also involved in various clinical trials, and he is a co-investigator in many of them. He is the chairman of Med Titans Management Services, which extends expertise in management in the health sector. Thank you so much for choosing to be a part of this endeavor, Doctor. It will go a really long way for everyone involved.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Tanisha. I think it's a privilege that you've even asked me to be on this panel. I consider it my privilege. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So let's dive into the questions, Doctor.
Sure.
So there are many drugs that are prescribed for people who have heart failure. So what would you say are the side effects of statins and other drugs prescribed after heart failure?
Right. Now, first of all, a couple of things, you know, that I would like to clarify. Heart failure is a different entity on its own.
Mm-hmm.
You have situations like the cardiac spectrum in terms of adult cardiovascular disease extends from various structural heart diseases, where there are issues with the muscle, issues with the valves, issues with the aorta, et cetera, et cetera. From there, it extends on to the blood supply to the heart muscle, which basically means that you've got to realize that though the heart has got blood within it, it still survives on certain arteries which supply the heart muscle. Mm-hmm. So any deficiency of blood supply to the heart muscle can worsen the heart pumping. And that leads to heart failure. So the spectrum starts from angina, which is chest pain, mm-hmm. to a heart attack. A heart attack is what causes damage to the heart muscle. Damage to the heart muscle is what causes heart failure. So this is one part of it. The other part of it is the muscle gets involved with some illness. For example, now in COVID situations, we are seeing patients with COVID-induced inflammatory heart situation. So that reduces the heart pumping. So that situation where there's a reduction in the overall heart pumping, thereby leading to less blood being supplied to the various organs of the body, and the situations that arise thereof are known as the conundrum of heart failure. So when we talk about heart failure, there are various drugs which we give in heart failure. And these drugs can include drugs like diuretics, which improve the urine outflow, drugs to prop up the blood pressure, drugs to adjust the cardiac pumping, drugs to effectively improve the heart pumping overall by improving certain dynamics, et cetera. And of course, statins. Now, you asked me a question about statins. Statins are used not only in heart failure, but also in patients with heart disease, like blockages in the arteries. The work of statins is to reduce the cholesterol level. Also, it has certain, what we call as pleiotropic effects. That means it stabilizes the arterial wall. It helps in the overall function of the heart muscle also. The side effects of statins that we have are usually divided into two or three of them. One is a patient who cannot tolerate statin because of gastrointestinal side effects. That's a very rare population. Second is an effect on the liver. But that again happens statistically in about 2 to 3% of the entire population taking statins and is usually reversible. You stop the statin, that effect on the liver wears off. It is never a permanent damage to the liver. Third is an effect on the muscle. Some people complain of muscle pains, muscle aches. When they take statins, they say that they can't walk, the muscle pains, when they get up in the morning, the muscles ache. This is another side effect. And also, if you were to keep a regular follow-up on these patients and keep checking their blood levels, very often we can prevent or avoid these side effects. And mark you, the benefits of statins far outweigh the side effects of statins. I hope this answers your question.
Yes, thank you so much, doctor. That was very insightful. So doctor, a medical student had this question. So as compared to pre-pandemic, the post-COVID stroke cases have risen to like 2.5 times the original statistics. And a major cause of this is people's negligence, because even non-fatal heart attacks can cause long-term health issues. How do you think we can increase awareness about it at an individual level?
See, the basic issue with COVID has been a intense fear complex amongst, not only amongst patients, but also amongst doctors, the medical professionals, the nursing staff, et cetera, in terms of what can COVID do, and what happens if you contract COVID, because it's a very indisciplined illness that we can see. It doesn't follow any norms of a normal illness where we can define that an X patient gets into an X situation. And that's probably one of the reasons why, number one, patients seek help very late. They normally try to stay at home and try to manage the symptoms at home. Number two, we are also seeing an increase in episodes of heart disease, brain strokes, etc., increasing with COVID. And that's probably because COVID, as you know, is a prothrombotic illness, which means that it has a propensity to form clots, not only in the artery supplying the heart muscle, but it also causes strokes in the brain. Mm-hmm. So that is another reason why patients who have COVID are at a higher propensity to develop these complications associated with COVID. We have clots going into the lungs also. So two or three reasons that I can define. One, of course, is the fact that people have a general aversity to coming into hospitals and going and seeking medical attention for the simple fact that they are worried about contracting COVID, or they're worried about being tested for COVID in multiple places where multiple hospitals, multiple clinics do test patients for COVID before admitting them for any other thing. Second, they arrive late at the hospital because they try to manage the symptoms at hospitals. So by the time they reach the hospital, they're already beyond a certain stage of treatment, which could have potentially helped them. Third, COVID is itself a prothrombotic situation where COVID patients have a propensity to develop clots in the arteries and thereby leading to strokes, leading to heart attacks, leading to lung pulmonary embolisms, leading to clots in the leg, and various other issues that are seen. Now, you've seen that there was a series of patients who had clots in the intestines also. So it underlines the fact that we still have a lot to learn about this disease in terms of these situations.
Yeah. So doctor, and the medical student also had a question regarding the advantages and disadvantages of a traditional transplant and a heterotrophic one.
Heterotrophic transplant is something which is a very unusual and very, very rarely done transplant situation. It's basically a situation where you piggyback another heart on the patient's own heart in order to increase the overall effect of the transplant. You know, transplants are done when the heart fails and there is nothing else that works. No medications work, nothing, and no assist devices work. And thereby you go in for a transplant. So situations that when I myself have never come across a heterotrophic transplant. It's a very rarely done procedure. And usually these are situations limited to very few situations, as I've been told also by my colleagues who are active in the heart transplant program, that this is done basically one in a patient who's extremely obese. And as you know, a heart of a 20 kilo, 45, 30, 50 kilo person will not fit into a 140 kilo person. So you need something extra to do the pumping. So any additional pumping, it would be beneficial. And in that situation, you use two hearts in place of one. One is the patient's recipient's heart, and the second is the donor heart. So that's a situation where you would use a heterotrophic transplant. The only other situation where I would use a heterotrophic transplant, as I've been told, is basically in patients with severe increased pressures on the right side of the heart, where they use a second heart to increase the pumping of the right side, because that is one situation which can be fairly difficult to manage.
Thank you so much for that, doctor. So doctor, how do sodium glucose cotransporter 2 or CGL2 inhibitors work?
The mechanisms of cardiovascular benefits of sodium glucose cotransporter 2, that is SGLT2 inhibitors, are based upon the fact that it basically has effects in terms of the glucose metabolism. It inhibits the reabsorption of glucose from the kidney. It first came as an anti-diabetic, and subsequently it was seen that it has a lot of cardiovascular outcomes. It had benefits in cardiovascular disease. It benefits in patients with heart failure and improving cardiovascular outcomes in patients with heart failure. That's how it came to be a prominent cardiovascular drug too. At the same time, the mechanisms of action of SGLT2 inhibitors in terms of the way it actually works in cardiovascular outcomes has never been completely defined. There are multiple mechanisms by which it is supposed to work. But we do know that there have been various studies on this drug in terms of cardiovascular outcomes. And today, the drug is used even for patients who are non-diabetic and in patients with cardiac failure to improve cardiovascular outcomes. Having said that, any new drug has to be taken with a little bit of caution. There are certain riders which come with the drug, and those have to be followed. And it is definitely not useful for acute heart failures and in patients with compromised kidney functions, where what we call as a creatinine clearance is less than 30. Now, how it works, various mechanisms in terms of this thing is supposed to lower the blood pressure, though the effect of blood pressure lowering is very less. It causes more urine output. Therefore, that is one of the possibilities. Third thing is it improves cardiac energy metabolism, which is absolutely essential in a failing heart. Fourth, it works basically on reducing the inflammation in the heart muscle. It causes weight loss, improves glucose control, inhibits the sympathetic nervous system, which basically acts as one of the detrimental factors in cardiac failure. And more importantly, it helps in cardiac remodeling. Cardiac remodeling is where the heart either becomes thick or too thin and becomes dilated. And this drug has been found to have certain beneficial effects as far as that is concerned.
Okay. So, doctor, I had the privilege of working at a cath lab with a surgeon, and I don't think I'll be able to do justice to explaining the process of an angioplasty. Would you care to explain it for listeners?
Well, if I were to put it, it's difficult to explain the procedure of an angioplasty, but basically, what you need to realize is, like I said, the heart has certain arteries on the surface of the body, on the surface of the heart, which supply muscles, which supply blood to the muscles of the heart. There are typically three big arteries, two on the left, one on the right. It doesn't mean the right is supplying the right heart. It just means that it comes from the right side of the aorta, it comes from the front and the right coronary sinus. Now, over a period of time, as cholesterol builds up in the arteries, in those people who have propensity for it, the lining of the artery starts getting embedded with cholesterol. And when that happens, it narrows the lumen down of the vessel. And when there's luminal narrowing of the vessel, it automatically leads to reduced blood supply. And that reduced blood supply leads to symptoms of angina and chest pain, limitations in terms of exercise. And at the same time, if it closes off by any chance, it causes a heart attack. So angioplasty was first started way back in 1978-79 by Andreas Grunzig. It was quite an innovative technique at that time for a person to think that he can open up a block by using a balloon. So they designed everything in a kitchen and they sterilized those materials. And the first angioplasty was done by using a balloon, which opened up the block. What you do is you pass a wire across the block, which is basically 0.014 inch in diameter. So it's almost like two hairs being put together.
Yeah.
That's the thickness of the wire. That wire goes through. Over it, you thread a balloon. which is made of PTFE or polyethylene. And you dilate the open up the balloon to clear up the block, to open up the vessel. That is the first stage of angioplasty. And when we used to do that in the 90s, when we used to use only balloons to open up the blockages. However, we did realize that almost 50% of those arteries which we opened came back with blockages, because when we open up something with a balloon, we use pressures of almost 12 to 15 PSI. Inside the artery, that's square inch, and that's quite a high pressure. When you do that, you do cause injury inside the vessel, and as a reaction to injury hypothesis, there's going to be scar formation. Mm-hmm. And this scar, higher the scar formation, higher the chances that the artery will block off, and the artery can re narrow again. That is number one. Number two was almost 10 to 15% of those patients we opened up with a balloon, they suddenly closed off in the first 1 week because of a clot formation or because the arterial lining was too thin to remain open. Now, in order to prevent that, came the stents. Stents were metallic jackets it's a wire mesh, initially made out of stainless steel and now made up of various materials like cobalt chromium, cobalt platinum, nitinol, etc., which basically keep the artery open and prevent it from falling back. Mm-hmm. So the first stents still had a higher recurrence. Subsequently, in order to reduce the recurrence, they came out with something called as drug eluting stents, which are the ones that are used now, which have a certain drug which reduces the incidence of recurrence by reducing the stimulation of proliferation of cells, and thereby improving the long-term outcomes of these patients. So this is angioplasty in a nutshell.
Thank you, doctor. That was very insightful. Doctor, what would you say is the ideal blood pressure? And if a person's BP is too high, what are the possible reasons?
If the blood pressure has been something which has been a matter of debate. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the levels of blood pressure that are recommended, has been falling over the period of years based upon various studies in terms of what is an optimal blood pressure. Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at the American College of Cardiology guidelines, anything less than 120 is supposed to be normal. 120 is technically supposed to be pre-hypertensive. 120 over 80 is supposed to be pre-hypertensive. A patient who is hypertensive, the goal of treatment is to maintain the blood pressure around 130 to 140 systolic, and below 90, ideally around 80 diastolic. In patients with failure, patients with diabetes, the goal of treatment is 130 over 80 is what the blood pressure should be maintained at. What are the side effects of having high blood pressure? High blood pressure affects various organs. It affects the brain, it can cause strokes, it affects the kidneys, it can cause kidney failure, it affects the heart, it can cause heart attacks, it affects the arteries in the peripheries, can cause blockages in the arteries in the legs, etc. And more importantly, extremely high blood pressures can cause two life-threatening situations. One is something called as a dissection of the aorta, where the aorta tears, the lining of the entire aorta tears, and that is potentially a life-threatening situation. And the second is something called as an intracranial bleed, or a bleeding inside the brain, which is again 95% fatal.
Okay, so on a similar note, what would you say is the ideal BMI or body mass index for a healthy heart?
I think an ideal body mass index would be about 18.5 to 24.9, and anything beyond 25 is obesity, and anything beyond 30 is supposed to be extremely obese.
Got it.
So we maintain our body mass index between 18.5 to 24.9, which is an ideal body mass index. Mm-hmm. And anything below that is, of course, underweight. So the issue is, you need to understand one thing, that even for a person with a 23 body mass index, if you compare an Indian with a European, mm-hmm. we are at a higher risk because we have something called as abdominal obesity, visceral obesity, visceral fat.
Yeah.
And that has been found specifically in the Indian, and therefore the concept of the thin fat Indian, You find can find people who are thin, but they have an extremely high content of visceral fat, which is not seen outside.
Hmm.
So you may find a person who's fit enough within the body mass index, but because of his distribution of fat, his propensity for developing cardiac problems is extremely high.
Got it. That was very interesting. I didn't know that. So I always ask every surgeon that I interview what their most interesting case is, and most of them say that they can't pinpoint one. But in case you do have an interesting case that you remember or that you can pinpoint, what would it be?
We have had many interesting cases, but one thing which comes to mind, which is very gratifying, is because this happened during the COVID times, when a 60-year-old lady came with a massive heart attack, and she came in with a blood pressure of just about 70, 75 systolic, 75, and these were COVID times when everyone was worried to do anything very aggressive, and we knew that this patient with a massive heart attack, obese lady, is probably going to die and not going to make it.
Mm-hmm.
But we did take a chance. We took her for an emergency procedure in the night, and we realized that she had had a heart attack. The artery which is supposed to have caused the heart attack had opened up on its own, but it had left behind severe damage in that it had caused a leak in one of the major valves. So we put her on a balloon pump, which is to sort of support the circulation. And we said that we'll ask a surgeon to see, because her valve was torrentially leaking. Her valve was a mitral valve was completely torn, and it was torrentially leaking.
Mm.
So that is the reason why she was in shock, and her blood pressures were low, and she was in cardiac failure. So we put her on a ventilator, put a balloon pump. We asked one of the surgeons to see, and she had no brain activity at that time because she was completely obtunded. One of the surgeons refused to take for surgery, saying that she looks like she's brain dead, and that she's not going to make it. But we requested the surgeon that, another surgeon actually took up the gamut and said that let's give it a try for whatever it is worth. We explained to the relatives that we're going to give it a try, because if you don't, she dies. If we try and we manage it, we probably have, there's a 4-5% chance that she may survive. Mm-hmm. We took up that thing, and the patient's operated, and we realized that her entire valve was torn from inside. So the valve was replaced, and she had a lot of issues after that. She developed paralysis of both the something called as a Guillain-Barré syndrome. She was on a ventilator for almost a month. She was on something called as ECMO, which is keeping the patient on an extra corporeal oxygenator outside of the heart-lung machine, outside the body. She was on all those things in the hospital for almost a month and a half. And eventually, God's grace, God was kind, she went home in a wheelchair. And the last I know, she's been walking around at home, doing all her normal stuff. And the best part was, in the middle of this, her granddaughter, must be hardly 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years old, sent me a small drawing that she had done, and saying, thank you for giving, please send my grandmother home fast.
That's fantastic, doctor. Kudos to you. That's really nice to hear. Finally, doctor, what words of wisdom do you have for listeners who aspire to pursue medicine and surgery?
Whatever you do, be true to yourself, completely ethical to the patient. The patient comes to you with a, don't do something. Treat the patient as you would your own relatives, and be as ethical as you can. And that's the only advice that I would give any newcomer.
Thank you so much for this, doctor. It was a pleasure having you on board for this. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Tanisha.